service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jimi Hendrix died at the age of 27, and he lived a life perilously close to the edge. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 6 would be the number of strings that rang out, sizzled, sang, and vibrated when Jimi Hendrix touched them with his long fingers. Fingers that would summon forth sounds that to this day, 50 years later, remain unique to him. Almost like he was a magician first and a musician second. Another one would be the number of times that Miles Davis made a last-minute extortion attempt before a recording session with Jimmy. Because who wouldn't pay Miles and Jimmy a ridiculous amount of cold hard cash to jam in the studio for a day? 10 more would be the number of minutes Eric Burdon would have to frantically bury drugs in a garden before an ambulance arrived at the rented flat where Jimmy lay unresponsive in bed. And another 10 would be the number of Vesperix pills that Monica Daneman would find strewn around Jimmy's bed and floor just hours before he would be declared dead at St. Mary Abbott's Hospital. All totaling 27. On this, our 11th episode of Season 1, Sizzling Strings, Hard Bop Extortion, Buried Drugs, A Lifeless Body, and the Always Searching Jimi Hendrix. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Eric Burdon was on his hands and knees, digging frantically in the garden. He yanked a handful of green leaves from the ground and threw them to the side. A cluster of flowers were upended, a brightly colored casualty. He made a small crater in the soil, dug down a few inches, dirt under his fingernails. His heart was pounding. He thought he heard sirens in the distance. He stuck his soil-encrusted hands in the pockets of his jeans to retrieve all of the contraband he had grabbed from the tables and floors in Monica's rented flat. An assortment of pills, small bags with powdery contents, two thick but tightly wrapped joints. He shoved it all into the hole he had created, and then started to heap clumps of soil back on top. The garden plot was small, framed by an ornate black wrought iron fence. It was directly next to the small set of stairs that led into Monica's apartment at the Semmerk end. People walked by on the sidewalk, going about their daily business, usually Friday morning stuff, almost lunchtime. Eric was small enough a man to go relatively unnoticed, obscured partially by the fence and the plants growing around it. The knees of his jeans sank into the wet soil. He tried to make everything look as undisturbed as possible, but a tidy garden was the least of his worries right now. Jimi Hendrix was in that apartment. He wasn't awake minutes ago when Eric was in there. He wasn't moving, and Eric wasn't even sure if he was breathing. Monica had mentioned on the phone that he had puked all over himself in bed, but Eric didn't have time to confirm any of that. He was in full panic mode, collecting as many drugs as he could before the authorities showed up. The cops would have a field day if they entered that room and found all this shit. The grass, the powder, the pills, the pipes, and the papers, and the baggies. Eric didn't pause long enough to sort out exactly what it all was. It just all had to go, in the ground, buried below. Because it wouldn't just be Jimmy's ass that the police would be after. It would be all of them. Collateral damage, guilt by association. They'd go after Monica, Chaz, Mitch, Billy, Jeffrey. Just look at the Grateful Dead's drug bust in New Orleans earlier that year. The Dead weren't the only ones who got pinched. 19 others were arrested. Dealers, roadies, friends, locals who were partying with them. If you were in the orbit, you'd be on the list. Yes, we're going high, 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 high on Magic Mountain. We're never coming down. Eric knew he'd be at the top of the cops' hit list. Shit, he had just jammed with Jimmy a few nights earlier. He'd been playing at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club in Soho with War, the new band he'd formed with a crew of California musicians who'd been backing L.A. Rams vet Deacon Jones. Their first single, the Latin-tinged absurd funk tale, Spill the Wine, had flowed freely from radios and turntables all over the world earlier that summer. It was a few nights ago, September 15, Jimmy showed up at Ronnie Scott's looking to sit in with Burden and the boys, get his jam on. He didn't have his guitar with him, which Eric thought was super strange, but something else was missing besides his guitar. Jimmy had been out of it, like completely zonked. He had bumbled up to Eric, his eyes almost fully closed, his speech slurring. Eric figured he was rolling on a handful of ludes, maybe even some smack. War's harp player, Lee Oscar, made eye contact with Eric for long enough to give him a dismissive head shake. Jimmy wasn't getting near their stage that night. Imagine that, shaking off the greatest guitar player in the world from climbing onto your stage. Imagine telling yourself that you didn't want Jimi Hendrix, of all musicians, to join you on the stage to play music with. Dude had to have been wicked messed up to warrant that call. And the next night was a different story. War was back on stage at Ronnie Scott's, and Jimmy came around again, and this time, he was with it, was sober enough to give Eric and the band confidence. And Jimmy joined the big band, playing through Mother Earth and Tobacco Road, delivered the kind of frenetic R&B solos he had cooked up years before when he was back in the Isley Brothers and Little Richard. Like he was closing up some circle, back from the psychedelic wilderness to that slinky, raw sound that reminded him of the music he had come up on. As Eric continued to ensure the drugs were safely hidden beneath dug-up soil, he thought about all the other times he had sweated out with Jimmy. Playing music, partying. He thought of the day the previous year when he and Jimmy sat on the roof of Jimmy's Brook Street flat in London, near the American Embassy, and watched a serpentine anti-Vietnam protest saunter by. Satisfied with the rush burial job, Eric needed to scram. He'd have to check in with Jimmy and Monica later. He thought back on the advice he had first given Monica when she had called in a panic. She was looking for a doctor, looking for a friend, desperately looking for advice. Give him black coffee, Eric had suggested. Give his face a good slap, knock him out of it. And Jimmy had gone to that place before, that place where sleep and drugs met. Hell, they'd all gone there before. Some caffeine, a little backhand, he'd come to. How stupid that advice seemed to him now. His wrist deep in the earth outside the stoop of 22 Lansdowne Crescent. An assortment of evidence and paraphernalia shoved sloppily into the ground, his friend unresponsive inside, on a bed. When he realized how serious Monica was on the phone, Eric ran over to her flat in record time. He had minutes to pretty the place up, prepare, steel themselves for whatever was about to happen, for what was coming. Monica had called for an ambulance. From the wailing siren sounds could be heard just blocks away, the paramedics would be there in a matter of moments. The continent of Australia fell easily. There simply weren't enough troops to defend it. It had been taken for granted. Australia, small as continents go. Hidden away in a remote corner of the world, easy pickings. The invading hordes outnumbered the local armies by about 2-1. Australia may have had a fighting chance, but within seconds it was a casualty of war. The dice tumbled from Jimmy's hand and the battle was his. Sweet victory. Jimmy chuckled and swept Chaz Chandler's armies from the risk board. Moved his armies into Australia, knocked the chunk of ash hanging off the end of his dunghill into the nearby ashtray, and took a drag. Chaz laughed too, but he wasn't out of this fight. There was plenty of world left to conquer. And after all, there was no limit to their time. Two old friends could do this all night. Talk, smoke, plot, laugh, play risk. It was almost meditative. It was late on Wednesday night. September 16, 1970. Chaz's baby and wife slept in the next room at Chaz's London flat. The place was quiet. The room had Jimmy and Chaz's attention. It had been a long time coming. On the last few nights of his life, Jimi Hendrix was busy making plans. Despite a lack of sleep, he was beginning to feel clear-headed, fresh, engaged, alert. He was staring down a few days off in London. It would do his body good. And with this clear head, Jimmy began to take stock of his world. He needed to make some changes, and nothing could change until Michael Jeffrey was out of the picture. Jeffrey's contract as Jimmy's manager was expiring next month in October. His time was up. He was dead weight, anxiety-producing dead weight, and he had to go. Jeffrey had racked up debts, sabotaged the band of gypsies, undermined Jimmy's artistic impulses, gotten Jimmy mixed up with the mob, may have dosed him with bad LSD, waved a little gun around as he did it. The whole time, Jeffrey was playing some game to keep Jimmy preoccupied and complacent, distracting him with things. The studio in New York City, the house outside of Woodstock, drugs, endless touring, a two-faced Svengali, ruthlessly all business on one side, wannabe Hepcat getting stoned with the cool kids on the other. All the while, chasing that dollar. And what did Jimmy have to show for it? He had no idea how much money he had or where it was kept if he wanted to get it. And Jimmy saw through the bullshit. He needed to make up for lost time, get a plan in place. And that plan started with Chaz. That night in Chaz's flat, Jimmy apologized. Chaz had been right about everything. Jeffrey seemed right at the time back when he and Chaz parted ways, but hindsight was 20/20. And Jimmy could see that now. He missed Chaz's creativity, his loyalty. He wanted Chaz back in the producer's chair. They could record in London, away from the human zoo that was seemingly inseparable from Electric Lady Studios. Chaz was game. It was all water under the bridge. Jimmy had gone to the wilderness, and now he was back. Another key player in Jimmy's plan was Alan Douglas. Jimmy wanted him as part of his new and improved management team. Alan Douglas was the former head of United Artists' jazz division in the 60s. The roster of artists he'd worked with was deep. Duke Ellington, Charles Mingus, Max Roach. Most recently, he'd worked with The Last Poets, who would be credited as a proto-hip-hop outfit years later. Alan Douglas had his finger firm against the pulse. Alan had introduced Jimmy to Miles Davis a few years back, and the two of them kept dancing around a collaboration. They enjoyed each other's music, appreciated each other, would go to each other's shows, hang out afterwards, and talk shop. They were both looking to transcend their respective genres, do something new, do something groundbreaking. Perhaps they could both help the other get there. The much-talked-about Jimi Hendrix-Miles Davis album that never happened is one of those great lost what-ifs in rock music history. And Alan almost made it happen, too. He worked with Jimmy and Miles to find the right time, find the right place, worked around touring schedules, made sure that everyone was comfortable, prepared, ready to get down. 30 minutes before the session was to start, Miles approached Alan. "Yo, Alan," Miles said in his trademark back alley growl, "I need to get paid $50,000 before I even walk in that room." The drummer, Tony Williams, stood next to Miles. He was young, but he was no chump. He doubled down, asked Alan for the same payout. "The ball's on these guys. Ain't that a motherfucker?" Miles said as he turned around and walked the other way. The session never happened. But you know what did happen? Bitches Brew, a highly experimental 1970 Miles Davis album that is arguably the result of Miles spending lots of time hanging out with Jimi Hendrix. So guess who happened to be in London during this last stretch of days that Jimmy was there, taking stock and making plans? Alan Douglas. On the day he met with Chaz, Jimmy also met with Alan. Would he manage Jimmy? Consider it. They talked about the directions in which Jimmy wanted to take his music. Alan hadn't been able to make the Miles thing happen. Let's be honest, Miles did what Miles wanted to do, and sometimes there was nothing anyone could do about it. But what about Gil Evans, the pianist and arranger who worked with Miles? Jimmy was imagining a big band, and then an even larger orchestra helmed by Gil Evans. Alan was inspired, and they'd find a way to make it happen. The next night, September 17th, Jimmy's head was full of these conversations, full of possibilities. "My mind's been going through them changes." His mind was full speed ahead, racing, wired, but also clogged up, not enough sleep, peppered with alcohol, pills, grass. "Every time you see me going somewhere, I feel like I'm going out of my mind." At Monica's flat at the Semerkin that night, he channeled his head full of everything into his art. He sat down at the kitchen table, put pen to paper, a brain dump, fueled by wine and exhaustion and the promise of some positive changes, a new rising sun. The story of life is quicker than the wink of an eye. The story of love is hello and goodbye until we meet again. The last lyrics Jimmy ever wrote, the story of my life, are a bit inspirational poster caliber, especially coming from the guy who once wrote about butterflies and zebras and moonbeams and fairy tales, about mountains falling into the sea and hippies cutting off their hair. They make reference to the story of Jesus, to the life cycle of humanity. Big ideas tumbled forth. I'm you searching to be free, he wrote. When Eric Burdon found the lyrics the next morning as he cleared the apartment of anything incriminating, he held the handwritten sheet in his hands. He read the lyrics, and then he reread them, turned the page over again and again, his fingers trembling, his brow sweating. After he had finished getting rid of the drugs, the sirens getting closer, Jimmy's body was still inside the apartment, and Eric heard no sounds coming from inside. What were the odds, he thought? What were the odds that the paper he was holding in his hands was Jimi Hendrix's suicide note?
We'll be right back after this
word.
On the day that Jimi Hendrix died, Monica Daneman was awake early. Jimmy and Monica had been up all night when the sun rose that morning. Monica made him a tuna sandwich in the wee hours. The kitchen in the flat was accommodating. Its windows were open to the incoming sunlight as it bled into London. And they talked, and they drank some wine, and talked some more. Monica popped one of her sleeping pills, Vesperex. Half a tab was good enough. The whole damn thing would send the Sandman to you real quick. She fell asleep at 7 a.m., and Jimmy was still awake, still talking. She was up by 10 a.m., early for someone who had gone to sleep only 3 hours before, early for someone who was romantically involved with a musician. When she woke up, she went on a search for smokes. They had smoked all the cigarettes in the apartment the night before. Jimmy liked the smokes. The way the smoke emanated from his body was an extension of what was going on with him at the moment. When he was happy, a smile would fill up his face and the smoke from his cigarette would plume ahead of him, hang there like a smile. When he was lost in thought, the smoke would trail delicately from the end of his cigarette and dissolve in this pensive way. The smoke itself was pensive. As they ran low on cigarettes that night, Jimmy had offered to go out to buy reinforcements. Monica stopped him. She enjoyed having him to herself, didn't want to get up, didn't want him to get up, didn't want to change her position. One of them would go out in the morning, and they'd worry about it later. And so here she was. It was later. She was awake. Jimmy still asleep in bed. No smokes. Nothing to pass the time while she paced around the flat, waiting for Jimmy to wake up. So she went searching for cigarettes. She walked out into the sidewalk of Lansdowne Crescent. She felt good, happy, fulfilled. A little nicotine would make things even better. The day before had been one for the books. At least it had started that way. Monica got Jimmy to herself as the day began. She had his complete attention. For Jimmy, it was an unusually reserved day. No shows, no interviews, no planes, no studios. He didn't have to do anything he didn't want to do. The day was his to spend how he wanted, and he spent a great deal of it with Monica. She got out her camera and took photos of Jimmy in the garden. He posed with his black Fender Stratocaster. They had tea, and they went shopping at Kensington Market, a three-story emporium for hippie and bohemian fashion. Jimmy bought some clothes, and they were far out. While they were out, they ran into Devin Wilson. Monica was immediately suspicious. Devin had a way of showing up and coaxing that darkness out of Jimmy, just when he was on a more positive path. Devin invited them to a party later that night at Pete Cameron's house, co-founder of Track Records, Jimmy's London record label. Jimmy said they'd be there. Monica was beyond pissed. Fucking Devin Wilson, that black widow bitch. She would do whatever she could do to keep tabs on Jimmy, to keep him in her sights, her clutches, keep him hooked on whatever she was doling out so he wouldn't dole out too far himself, too far away from her. What in the hell did Devin Wilson even have without Jimi Hendrix? A guitar player here, a record producer there, a couple of glorified one-night stands with a handful of famous people? Monica stood at Jimmy's side, smiled and nodded at Devin as they spoke. Of course, they would love to. Thanks so much for the invite. How serendipitous that Devin ran into them on the streets of London, of all places. What a world. fucking manipulative bitch. Did she not get the memo? Jimmy belonged to Monica now. He was gonna put a ring on it. He didn't want that crazy-ass junkie lifestyle any longer. Didn't want to be strung out and moody. Didn't want to be searching anymore. He had found what he was looking for, and it was a German ice skating instructor who would do anything to keep him by her side. Bye, Devin. On their way back to Jimmy's hotel room, Jimmy and Monica were approached in traffic by a random Londoner. He rolled down the window of his Ford Mustang, and there were a couple of teenage girls in the back seat. Asked Jimmy if they wanted to join him for tea. Jimmy laughed, thought of the plaster casters in Chicago. He thought of the pimply teenager in Seattle. He thought, too, of the wannabe wise guys in New York. But when it came to unsolicited offers by random people on the street, Jimmy had like a 66% success rate. So, why the fuck not? It turned out the guy with the Mustang was the son of an English lord. His house was out of this world extravagant. They smoked a Herculean amount of hash, like you do in the house belonging to the son of an English lord. Drank some wine and some tea, of course. It was London, after all. You can't have your hash and wine without a little tea. Monica was irritated by how long they stayed at the so-called lord's house. It was a little ostentatious for her taste, and Jimmy seemed more interested in their host than he did in her. And she was even more irritated when Jimmy said he was attending the party at Pete Cameron's place later that night, the one that Devin Wilson would be haunting, like a goddamn walking ghost. Monica begrudgingly dropped him off. She waited for him, picked him up when he was ready, and brought him back to her flat. Tuna sandwich, wine, talk, sleep. Okay, so the day hadn't been as perfect as she thought. When she reflected back on it, but she clung to the parts that she liked, the parts where she was the only thing Jimmy was focused on. It could take a minute for Monica to wean him off the crutches he'd gotten used to. Drugs, women, parties, strangers, attention. But she could do it. He could be hers. She got back to her flat at the Samarkand about half an hour later, returned victorious, a lit cigarette between her pointer and middle fingers and three packs of Dunhills in the other hand. She didn't hear Jimmy when she got back, and she didn't really expect to. He had fallen asleep later than her, after all, and he would likely be out for a while. She walked quietly into the bedroom and looked at the man of her dreams in the midst of his own dreams on the big queen-size mattress. And what she saw took a moment to process. Jimmy was on his back, still in the purple shirt from the day before, and the blue jacket with the dramatic lapels, sleeping, or so she thought. His eyes were closed, but his chest wasn't rising and falling. That's when she noticed his face, covered in chunks, glistening, wet, peach-colored, bits of red and pink and some black, too. His face was littered with vomit. It was on the pillow, too. The whole room stunk. Fuck. Holy fuck. Her Vesprix pills were scattered around the bed. She hadn't noticed them when she woke up earlier, and they were strewn on the comforter, the pillow, handfuls of them on the floor. She screamed. She felt a shock surge through her back as she came to understand what she was looking at, and she screamed again. The Dunhill between her fingers dropped to the floor. Her hands grabbed Jimmy's arms and she shook him, violently. She tried to force his body straight through the mattress. She was shaking him so hard. She thought of Devin Wilson and the English lord's heir and all the other people who wanted Jimmy for themselves, and her rage bubbled up. It came to the surface, hot, charged, unsatisfied, entitled. She shook Jimmy's lifeless body and saw Devin's face and his face, skeletal, visceral, an apparition. Monica was going to shake Devin out of Jimmy's body once and for all. She would exorcise that bitch for good. And the more she shook him, the more nothing happened. There was no moment of transcendence. Devin didn't ceremoniously leave Jimmy's body. Jimmy didn't wake up. It was just Monica's screams, the vibration of the mattress, the pieces of vomit loosening on Jimmy's face. Cold reality. Monica realized that she had to call someone. She needed help. A doctor. No, a friend. She picked up the phone next to the bed and dialed the first number that came to mind. Eric Burden. He'd know what to do. Call an ambulance, Eric told her. And then, suddenly, breathlessly, don't do anything else. Don't touch anything. He was on his way over. Chaz Chandler stepped off the train in Newcastle to find his father waiting for him. It was unlike his father to meet him anywhere, let alone on the platform of a railway station. The last time he had even seen his father at a train station was years ago, when he left home with the animals as they got popular and outgrew their hometown. His father was there to ceremoniously wave goodbye, bittersweet, surely, based on the twinkle he saw in his father's eye that day, years ago, probably more sweet than not. Chaz had taken the trip up north from London to visit with his family, show off the new baby, decompress and noodle on the whole Jimmy situation, now that Jimmy was looking to bring Chaz back into the fold. His father approached him quickly, as soon as he was off the car, had taken two steps on the platform. His father was looking around nervously as if he was being followed or was expecting someone to jump out of the crowd. It was all very strange. "Dad," Chaz shouted, and the two shook hands. This was quite the surprise. Then he saw the reporters, the press. They spotted Chaz from afar, had been prowling around the train as the passengers deboarded. They began to move in, swarm. "I'm here to help you get home quick," his father said, leading Chaz and his young family away from the train like a bomb was about to go off. "Let's cut through the crowd over here. We can probably lose them." Lose them? What the fuck was this, a hard day's night? Should Chaz have brought his disguised mustache with him? An oversized newspaper to hide his face behind? Just what exactly was going on? Why was his father there to rescue him from reporters? Why were the reporters even there at all? And why did it suddenly feel like this visit to Newcastle was not going to be anything like what he had expected? Chaz's father could tell that Chaz had no idea. Zero. He was completely in the dark. Had no one told him? Did he not know? "Jesus, Chaz." His father stopped in the middle of the crowd of people, all going this way and that. "Jimi Hendrix is dead." The doctors on duty at St. Mary Abbott's Hospital in Kensington declared Jimi Hendrix dead on arrival. His body lay on the table in the emergency room, as still as it had been in Monica's apartment, as still and lifeless as his body had ever been. The attending doctors attempted to resuscitate Jimmy inside the hospital, but they were just going through the motions, following protocol. This wasn't their first dead body rodeo. They knew a long-gone corpse when they saw one. They called it, time of death, 12:45 in the afternoon, Friday, September 18, 1970. On Monday of the following week, Eric Burdon went on the BBC television talk show 24 Hours with Jimmy's final lyrics to The Story of Life still haunting his head. He told the interviewer that it was clear that Jimmy had taken his own life. He had swallowed way too many of Monica's sleeping pills after writing a thinly veiled suicide note that doubled as song lyrics. Warner Brothers, Jimmy's record label, was having none of that suicide rap. They had a life insurance policy on Jimmy's life for $2 million. Standard operating procedure for labels ever since Otis Redding had died in a plane crash in 1967. If the insurance company thought that his death was a deliberate suicide, that meant the policy was null and void and Warners wouldn't see any of that money. Eric was leaving the television studios after the interview and was stopped by a record executive in the hallway. They got to him that fast, pushed him up against the wall, right in his face, hot breath, delivering fiery words, up close and personal. In no uncertain terms, the exec threatened Eric's career, his livelihood. If he was going to go on live TV and spout conspiratorial shit-stirring lies, he would find himself without a goddamn career. He would spill the fucking wine no more. And who else had a $2 million life insurance policy on Jimi Hendrix? None other than Michael Jeffrey. So, what the hell happened? How did Jimi Hendrix, the greatest guitar player in the world, wind up dead in a London flat at the age of 27, just as he was getting his shit together to make his next major reinvention? Did he really chug a lethal handful of sleeping pills? Did he think he was taking less than he did? Were the song lyrics a clue? Did he take his own life? Or did Michael Jeffrey have something to do with it? Was Jimmy worth more dead than alive to the manager who had overextended himself with mob money? Did Jeffrey call in his goon squad to off his prize star in the early morning hours? Or was it the first responders? Did they really bypass a closer hospital in order to delay their arrival? Did conservative racist ambulance drivers refuse to revive him and let him die as they merrily made their way to the hospital? The answers to some of these questions lay in the testimony of others. People who were there, people like James Tappy Wright, a longtime roadie and road warrior, who, one night, was told a deep, dark secret that he wished he had never heard. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The 27 Club is scored and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer, editor, and co-producer. The 27 Club is mixed and engineered by Sean Cahalan and Matt Bowden, both of whom lent their considerable music talent to the scoring of this series as well. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, and Season 2 will feature 12 episodes on Jim Morrison. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to the 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. You're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and please spread the word about the 27 Club. As always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other podcast, Disgraceland, and you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter, at DisgracelandPod. One way or another, I hope to be talking to you soon. Until then.